This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Think you're an expert on doing several things at once? Good. Hang on.
I've got my iTunes. I have my email. I've also got a game.
This month in Your Health, we'll hear about something we all do, even if we don't want to. Multitasking. We'll spend some time with teenagers.
That is extremely lame.
We'll also visit a lab to find out what the brain does and fails to do when it juggles many jobs. But first, NPR's John Hamilton begins our story in a place where you can hear multitasking, smell it, even taste it.
It's a diner.
Hi, how are you?
The Tasty Diner in Bethesda, Maryland.
One with scrapple, one with hash. One rye only.
To survive as a short-order cook here, you have to keep a half dozen orders in your head while flipping pancakes, cracking eggs,
bacon, egg and cheese bagel,
working the counter, and refilling coffee cups.
Half a grapefruit, please.
They're small tasks. On a busy day, though, they can add up to a tough job for Sean Swinson.
My first month here, I was ready to walk out the door.
Where's my oatmeal, Marisol?
What does it feel like when you're in the middle of rush hour? I mean, what does it feel like to...
Like you're in an insane asylum.
Stack.
Almost unbearable.
Scrambled ham steak. Over bacon. 1 week only.
Swinson has learned to handle the pressure.
Ready for another one, gentlemen?
He's an island of calm, even when the orders are flying.
Two orders of mini chocolate chips.
But Swinson's boss, Frank Long, says very few people can keep up without losing their cool.
And it's the most difficult job in this type of operation. Every table's occupied, four cooks, five waitresses, getting them in and out.
So when does it get the craziest? When the customers are multitasking too.
Lunchtime, people may have an errand to run, maybe go to the bank, maybe pick up some dry cleaning and eat. All, say, within an hour or whatever a lot of time they have.
It's all part of life these days. We answer emails while yapping on the phone. We schedule appointments while driving and listening to the radio. And it seems as if we're focusing on all these tasks simultaneously, as if we become true masters of doing 10 things at once. But brain researchers say, not so much.
People can't multitask very well. And when people say they can, it's usually because they're deluding themselves. The brain is very good at deluding itself.
Earl Miller, a Picower professor of neuroscience at MIT, says for the most part, we simply can't focus on more than one thing at a time. What we can do, Miller says, is shift our focus from one thing to the next with astonishing speed.
Switching from task to task, you think you're actually paying attention to everything around you at the same time, but you're actually not. You're paying attention to maybe one or two things simultaneously, but switching between them very, very rapidly.
Miller says there are several reasons the brain has to switch among tasks. One is that similar tasks compete to use the same resources in the brain.
Think about writing an email and talking on the phone at the same time. You cannot focus on one while doing the other. That's because there's a lot of what's called interference between the two tasks. They're very similar one another. They both involve communicating via speech or written word. And so there's a lot of conflict between the two of them, and they're really nearly impossible to do at the same time.
Researchers can actually see the brain struggling. And now they're trying to figure out the details of what's going on.
Just check and see if they're ready for you. Can you hang on 1 second right here?
We're at a lab at the University of Michigan in the control room of an MRI scanner. On the other side of a thick pane of glass, a young man is lying face up inside a giant magnet.
Okay, we're going to do another quick scan of your brain. You don't need to do anything. Just keep your head still.
The neuroscientist in charge is Daniel Weissman, who explains that the man in the scanner will be performing different tasks depending on the color of two numbers he sees on a screen.
And if the two digits are one color, say red, the subject decides which digit is numerically larger. On the other hand, if the digits are a different color, say green, then the subject decides which digit is actually printed in a larger font size.
Got that? If you didn't, maybe it's because these tasks were designed to be tricky.
Great. We're going to go ahead and begin.
MRI studies like this one have shown that when the man in the scanner sees green, his brain has to pause before responding to round up all the information it has about the green task. When the man sees red, his brain pauses again to push aside information about the green task and replace it with information about the red task.
If you can go ahead and try to respond a little faster for this next run, that would be great.
If the tasks were simpler, they might not require this sort of full-throttle switching.
All right, here we go.
But Weissman says even simple tasks can overwhelm the brain when we try to do several at once.
If I'm out on a street corner and I'm looking for one friend who's wearing a red scarf, I might be able to pick out that friend But if I'm looking for a friend who's wearing a red scarf and on one street corner, and in the middle of the street I'm looking for another friend who's wearing a blue scarf, and on the other side of the street I'm looking for a friend who's wearing a green scarf, at some point I can only divide my attention so much.
So the brain starts switching. Scan for red, switch. Scan for blue, switch. Scan for green, switch. The part of the brain that does this is called the executive system. It's a bit like one of those cartoon conductors telling the orchestra, louder, softer, faster, slower. The conductor in our heads lives in the brain's frontal lobes, basically above our eyes.
So executive processes allow us to make plans for our future behaviors. They allow us to exert some sort of voluntary control over our behavior.
The executive system also helps us achieve a goal by ignoring distractions.
So, for example, if we're performing a task where we want to watch TV and ignore voices that are coming from, I don't know, our children nearby, our frontal regions of the brain may configure the rest of the brain to prioritize visual information and dampen down auditory information.
And the brain's executive will keep us in that mode until we hear, say, one of our children screaming.
These are the things that make us most human. Humans are able to exert free will. We are not like jellyfish. It's not that when you poke us, we always do the same thing.
We're also not like cats or dogs or even apes when it comes to controlling how our brain responds and what it responds to. Weissman says this skill probably evolved to help humans, who are pretty vulnerable physically, do things like hunt animals that are bigger and stronger.
Hunting requires a lot of planning, right? You've got to think about, well, what's that tiger going to do? And I've got my group of friends. How can we coordinate ourselves and surround the tiger?
And keeping track of all of these things wouldn't be possible without the executive system, that symphony conductor in our frontal lobes.
You know, there are lots of animals in the world that hunt without these increased abilities. So I wouldn't say that to be a good hunter, you have to have a lot of frontal development. But on the other hand, it helps, right? This is why humans have become dominant on the planet.
And perhaps too confident in our own skill. Studies show that we frequently overestimate our ability to handle multiple tasks. For early humans, that sort of miscalculation could have meant becoming a tiger's lunch. These days, the consequences are more likely to be stress, a blunder, or a car crash. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And John's next reports look at the many ways that doing too much can mess with our heads.
It becomes a given that you will be multitasking, so you kind of, before you start, give up trying. You're teaching yourself to give like 10% to each thing.
If you still think you're a champion multitasker, yes, you, the one who's drinking coffee while you put on your makeup and chat on your cell phone while you drive, you can compare your skills with Sean Swinson, the cook interviewed for this story. A video of him at work is at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Blogg. On a stage at Washington University in St. Louis, the vice presidential nominees are about a third of the way through their one and only debate. Governor Sarah Palin and Senator Joe Biden have answered questions about the financial bailout, the economy, taxes, and climate change. We'll hear some of the exchanges coming up on All Things Considered, but first to the battleground state of Pennsylvania and one key group of voters, white men. Pennsylvania voted Democratic in recent presidential elections, and polls show Barack Obama leading there. But nationwide, among white male voters, surveys suggest more of an uphill battle for Obama. David Green went to talk to some of those voters in Fayette County, an hour south of Pittsburgh. It's a county that chose Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary.
This is the area of Pennsylvania that once powered the steel industry. Coal was taken from the ground here and heated into fuel.
You couldn't see the stars at night. All you saw was red sky.
Sam Woods, 84, he worked in those coal mines. They've since closed, and these days, Sam hangs out on a roadside selling ears of corn so sweet you can just dig in without cooking them.
All right, now, take a taste. Wow.
That's amazing.
My chomping away gives Sam a chance to tell me about the election.
I think our country's in bad shape. Now, see, I remember the other depression. I was only about 8 years old, but I got a good memory. For the time, we always had a man for the time when this country was in bad shape. I don't see none now.
He says he's thought about John McCain and isn't so sure.
Now, I like his vice president, not because she's good looking, but I think she's got a lot of common sense. She don't owe anybody anything in D.C.
And Sam says Sarah Palin is really the difference for him. He's voting for the Republican ticket. Now, he's a registered Democrat. He just says Barack Obama hasn't impressed him much.
Okay, I knew you were coming, but I didn't bake you no cake. Yeah.
Oh. Customers are pulling up in their cars for corn. Sam seems happy to pass me along to them.
Grab him, babe. Jump on him about the election.
He's introduced me to Rich Miner, who says he's thought long and hard about the election. He's 68, works for the local sewage authority, and says he voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary. These days, he says, he looks at John McCain and sees a carbon copy of President Bush, which he doesn't like.
Obama, I guess we take a chance on him. I mean, he's a rookie, but he sounds good.
This wasn't an easy decision for Rich. He says there was a time when he might not have supported a black candidate.
I myself at one time was very prejudiced, but I ain't no more. I don't know, I just changed my attitude. I'm around, well, I've always been around colored people I've worked with. I mean, I've always worked with them, and I found that early on that blacks sort of took advantage of the situation, but I don't know. Anymore, I don't know. I think they're okay. As long as they do their end of the job, I don't see nothing wrong.
So I ask Rich what he thinks of Obama doing the job as president.
He sounds like he's working for the middle class people. That's where he come from. Hopefully he's going to do us some good. That's the way I look at it.
He had data engineering.
Industries and businesses come and go in this part of Pennsylvania. But Fayette Engineering has hung on. Russ Meckling just retired as president after a long time.
1964 till now. That's not so long. That's 46 years.
Sitting in his office, he tells me he's voting for Barack Obama, but he doesn't go around boasting about it.
You know, it's a little hard when you think about back in the primary when 80% of your neighbors didn't vote for him, to go around telling people that, hey, you made a big mistake, you should have voted for him. She didn't win anyhow.
There's another reason he's careful. Russ says people here are struggling with something else.
You know, there still seems to be the race issue. Nobody admits it. It's not something that's ever mentioned. But I think there is a racial component there. It's there. And it shouldn't be.
Russ says he hopes people take a look at the other differences between Obama and McCain.
I think there are people who have been telling themselves and telling their friends and neighbors that they just wouldn't vote for Obama, who are thinking now that, well, wait a minute, given the choice, I think maybe I might vote for Obama. I think he'll do better in Fayette County than you might have expected.
Democratic candidates are used to doing well here. Clinton, Gore, and Kerry all won Fayette County. Now Barack Obama hopes to add his name to that list. David Green, NPR News, Uniontown, Pennsylvania.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Steve Inskeep is on assignment. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Governor Sarah Palin and Senator Joe Biden met for the first time last night on stage at Washington University in St. Louis. They squared off in the only vice presidential debate, certainly one of the most anticipated events of this campaign. Elsewhere in our program, we're bringing you a wrap-up of that debate and political analysis, plus reaction from voters at a debate viewing party. For the next few minutes, we're going to check the facts, just as predicted.
Tomorrow morning, you know, the pundits are going to start doing the who said what at what time, and we'll have proof of some of this.
Or at least a review, and some additional information on some of the key claims made by Sarah Palin and Joe Biden. I'm joined by a team of NPR reporters. And the candidates started by talking about the economy and the financial bailout, and that's where we will start as well. Frank Langfitt, you've been covering the financial bailout crisis. Governor Palin gave credit to John McCain for seeing the crisis ahead of time. Here's what she had to say.
2 years ago, remember, it was John McCain who pushed so hard with the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac reform measures. He sounded that warning bell.
Warning bell. What about it, Frank?
Well, Sarah Palin may be the only one or one of the few who would remember that. In fact, it was Chuck Hagel, the Republican from Nebraska, who led that effort back in around 2005 to tighten regulation. The only thing I could find from McCain was a press release co-sponsoring it. And keep in mind, you know, the New York Times recently reported that Rick Davis, McCain's campaign manager, got nearly $2 million to serve as president of a group that actually defended Fannie and Freddie against tougher regulations.
Now, the debate about the bailout turned pretty quickly to the candidates' plans for the economy, and there was a back and forth on taxes. Here's Joe Biden.
No one making less than $250,000 under Barack Obama's plan will see one single penny of their tax raise, whether it's their capital gains tax, their income tax, investment tax, any tax.
Frank, is that right?
Mostly. There's a little exaggeration in that individuals who are making around $200,000 would pay higher taxes. And initially they had proposed actually raising capital gains, but now they've promised there won't be any of that.
Well, the McCain campaign is making a different point. Sarah Palin basically accused Barack Obama of raising taxes historically.
Barack Obama even supported increasing taxes as late as last year for those families making only $42,000 a year.
Is that right?
Well, this is misleading. That particular thing she's talking about is a non-binding resolution. But basically, the Obama plan is focused on taxing the wealthiest people and reducing taxes for middle and lower income people.
Frank Langfitt, thank you very much. And we're joined now by Martin Kosty, who's in Alaska. And Martin, Governor Palin also talked about her record, and we've heard her say many times that she stood up to the big oil companies. She also repeated last night something that she said often, and that is we in Alaska are building a $40 billion natural gas pipeline. She takes credit for that, considers it quite important. What, in fact, is the case with that pipeline? Because there are those who say it may not even get built.
She's trying to get that built. She has been making this the centerpiece of her administration, really. She wants this gas line built, but the way she's going about it is contrary to the way the oil industry normally works around here. She has passed legislation that would offer state money to outside companies to come in and bid on this. Well, only one company did bid on it, but no ground has been broken on this thing, and it is a huge project, and the state stands to spend a lot of money before it becomes a reality if it follows her plan.
When you say the state stands to spend a lot of money, what kind of money are you talking about there?
Well, they're talking about $500 million in what they call seed money, which would buy the state more control over the project, but it certainly would be far more expensive up front for the state than the traditional way of building pipelines around here.
Thanks, NPR's Martin Kosty. And one more domestic issue. NPR's Julie Rovner covers health care. And Julie, listen with us to Sarah Palin speaking about the John McCain proposal for covering more Americans.
He's proposing a $5,000 tax credit for families so that they can get out there and they can purchase their own health care coverage. And that's a smart thing to do. That's budget neutral. That doesn't cost the government anything.
Now, Julie, is John McCain's health care tax credit budget neutral?
Well, in a word, no. At one point, it was. It looked like the part Sarah Palin didn't talk about is that the way they would pay for that $5,000 tax credit is by taxing the value of people's health insurance, and that the taxes that people would pay would offset the tax credit. Now, Senator Biden did talk about that taxing, and he kind of went a little bit overboard and suggested that everybody would pay more. Now, for most people, the tax credit would offset the value of the taxes that would be paid. However, because of a change that the McCain campaign made to their proposal, there's now an estimate by the Tax Policy Center that over 10 years, the McCain plan would cost an extra $1.3 trillion. So it's pretty clearly not budget neutral.
Julie Rovner, thanks very much. Now, shifting to foreign policy, the candidates went back and forth on Iraq and Afghanistan. So let's consider first this statement from Senator Biden.
We spend more money in 3 weeks on combat in Iraq than we spent on the entirety of the last 7 years that we have been in Afghanistan building that country. Let me say it again. 3 weeks in Iraq, 7 years, 7 years or 6.5 years in Afghanistan.
Tom Gelton, you cover intelligence and national security. Help us out here. Joe Biden is not comparing the full cost of the two wars here, is he?
No, Renee, but you had to be listening closely to get that nuance. In fact, a lot of us here thought at first he was saying that 3 weeks of war in Iraq cost as much as all 7 years of war in Afghanistan. But he was apparently comparing two different things, the cost of combat operations in Iraq and the cost of reconstruction in Afghanistan. You notice he said building that country. And if you compare those two things, he's not far off. We did find estimates from the Congressional Research Service that spending on foreign aid and diplomatic operations in Afghanistan over these last 7 years amounts to a little over $11 billion. That's since 2001. The CRS, meanwhile, puts Pentagon spending in Iraq over the last year as $145 billion. That comes out to about $8 billion per three-week period. So if you're comparing combat operations in Iraq and diplomacy in Afghanistan, then the statement is correct. But boy, that's, I think that went over the heads of a lot of people.
And Tom, meanwhile, Governor Palin argued that the surge principles from Iraq need to be applied in Afghanistan. But then she got the name of the commanding U.S. general in Afghanistan wrong, didn't she?
Yes, you referred to General McClellan. It's actually General McKiernan. Senator Biden then came back and said General McKiernan has not, in fact, backed a surge strategy for Afghanistan. But this is kind of a semantic point. General McKiernan, in fact, was quoted yesterday as saying that surge is not the right word to describe what's needed in Afghanistan. But then he went on to say that a lot more troops are needed in Afghanistan and they need to get there as soon as possible. So that sounds like a surge. I think it's really kind of a semantic point here.
Tom, thanks very much. Now we turn to Michelle Kellerman, who covers foreign policy and diplomacy. And let's sort something out that keeps coming up in these debates. The question is, should the next U.S. president sit down with the leaders of Iran, North Korea, other so-called rogue states without preconditions? Now, there's some question about what preconditions means versus preparation. But has Barack Obama ever said he would sit down with President Ahmadinejad?
Well, as with anything in diplomacy, there's always a bit of nuance here. Barack Obama did say early on in the campaign that he would meet with the leaders of those countries without preconditions. But as Biden pointed out, Obama never did specify that he would meet with Ahmadinejad. Senator Biden said Iran's a theocracy and the president isn't necessarily the most powerful person on national security issues. And what he didn't mention also is that there are actually elections next year in Iran. So all of this argument might be for naught.
Michelle Kellerman, thanks very much, and lots of ground to cover on last night's debate. We were helped in that by Tom Gelton, Julie Robner, Martin Costi, and Frank Langfitt. Thanks to you all for helping us sort out some of the facts.
With so much for content, we're listening not just for what the candidates say, but also how they say it. We're not talking style here, we're talking regional accents. First, Sarah Palin's. To the consternation of millions, and to the fiendish delight of Tina Fey, it has introduced the nation to what Alaskans sound like. Or has it? Some people say Palin talks more like Frances McDormand playing Police Chief Marge Gunderson in the movie Fargo.
Like I told you, we haven't had any vehicles go missing.
Okay. Are you sure?
Well, does that sound like this?
Reduce taxes, control spending, reform the oversight and the overseeing agencies and committees to make sure that America's dollars and investments are protected.
That's Governor Palin. And joining us from Philadelphia is University of Pennsylvania Professor of Linguistics William LeBove, who is an expert on regional American accents. You've listened to Sarah Palin. Is that an Alaskan accent?
Yes, she's a stone Alaskan compared to the two speakers from her area in our Atlas of North American English. She measures up pretty good.
Some people hear a lot of Minnesota in that speech. Are we wrong? Are there many similarities?
This is a northern dialect, a northwestern dialect. O is not pronounced go and ro as it is in the Midland and the South. But it's not the strong O of Minnesota. Just because she doesn't say go doesn't mean she's saying O.
When bureaucracy just gets kind of comfortable going with the status quo and not...
Are we hearing dialects that are influenced by Scandinavian speech or German speech?
No. This is the normal development of our West and Northern United States. The way the words that are spelled with A, short A, are pronounced. So like most of the people in that area, she will say can, hands, candidate, for any word where the letter A precedes M or N.
I answered him yes, because I have the confidence in that readiness and knowing that you can't blink. You have to be wired.
Other distinctive things about Sarah Palin's speech that have struck you from listening to her?
Well, she's great for reaching out in interviews, and she uses colloquial forms like gotta go and gotta remember very effectively. And then she is one of the people who say, I ran. And there are other people on the other side of the fence say Iran or Iran. So there's a lot of variation here, and she takes a strong stand on these points of pronunciation.
Well, I dare say this is entirely impressionistic, but I think that there are thousands, if not millions, of offices in America where somebody is doing the Sarah Palin impression over the past several weeks. It's obviously a compelling accent we've been exposed to. Less compelling, less exotic, to my ear at least, is the accent of Democratic vice presidential candidate Joe Biden.
Part of what a leader does is to instill confidence, is demonstrate that he or she knows what they're talking about and communicates to people, if you listen to me and follow what I'm suggesting, we can fix this.
He's talking and suggesting.
Yes, he's a great saying user of the IN form. Again, it's a political way of reaching out to people and being casual, and almost all candidates will do it. So they're similar in that respect. The big difference in the point of view of dialect is the one we talked about with the letter O and A-W. So you heard him say, talking.
Talking,
that's
yeah.
the East Coast difference. So he will say, walking the walk, and Washington, with that aw sound, which marks him as being a member of the Northeastern conurbation, that strip of people from Providence down to Wilmington, Delaware.
So I'm now imagining a Chinese skillet in my mind. The difference between walking the walk and walking the walk would be one difference between the two people debating tonight.
Yep.
Well, William LeBeau, thank you very much for talking with us today about it.
It's good talking with you.
It's William LeBeau, linguist at the University of Pennsylvania, and also the editor of the Atlas of North American English. Rush Limbaugh, Tom Joyner, Ryan Seacrest, Opie and Anthony, most of the biggest voices in daytime commercial radio are male voices. But the nighttime belongs to a female voice. Delilah Renee Luke has spent 25 years on the air, sending out dedications, telling stories, and playing soft rock music. Now she's making her first foray into a new medium. She's working on a series of nonfiction titles for Harlequin, the romance book people. Nate DeMayo has this profile of the woman some people say is about to become the Oprah of radio.
When you have 8 million listeners and a $50 million radio deal, who needs a last name?
Delilah. Put the kids in a cool bath and get them to bed, then light a candle. Do whatever you need to do to ease your troubled mind. I'm here to keep you company. You're listening to Delilah.
In listening to Delilah, you hear familiar light rock and soothing pop songs. It's like an audio-scented bubble bath. The heart of the show, though, are its callers. Each night, upwards of 100,000 people try to call in and make an on-air dedication and tell Delilah what's going on in their lives.
Hi, good evening, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
I am wonderful. How are you?
Oh, I'm always doing much better when I have a chance to listen to you.
She says she personally talks to between 200 and 300 callers off air every night, trawling for the best stories.
Oh, golly. I wanted to say that I have a missing heart tonight.
A missing heart. It has left your chest in the form of who?
Well, a darling, perfect man for me. His name is Julio.
Only a handful get on the air during her five-hour broadcast. They're mostly women. They call from all over and share stories of lost loves or found loves or loved ones deployed overseas. And Delilah listens to their stories of babies born or bouts with cancer or about men who can't commit and picks a song for them that she thinks gets to the heart of the matter. 'Cause I can't make you love me if you don't. You can't. Her dedications are usually pretty on the nose. People that call to say that it's good to know that they have a friend will likely hear James Taylor telling them the same thing. But people who think that someone is the wind beneath their wings are out of luck.
I love the fact that that song resonates with people and touches hearts, but come on, stop requesting it every night!
But despite her fatigue with a particular Bette Midler weeper, Delilah says she finds the job endlessly fascinating. She's a devout Christian, though the show isn't necessarily. Just non-denominationally inspirational.
God gives different people different gifts, and there are some people that can listen to an instrument and within a fraction of a second tell, you know, where it's off key or what note doesn't resonate correctly. And for me, I listen to voices, and I can hear in a voice layers of emotion or layers of feeling that the speaker probably doesn't even know is there.
I remember the first time I listened to her, you could hear her baby cooing in the background and her talking to her kid. And I thought, you know, this is something that every woman in America can relate to, or certainly most of them.
Industry analyst B. Eric Rhodes of the magazine Radio Inc. says there's no bigger nor more devoted audience in nighttime radio. Marquee brands have been flocking to advertise on the show in recent years. The publisher, Harlequin, is using Delilah to expand its own brand. For the first time, the romance book company is publishing a nonfiction title, a best of stories from Delilah and her callers. Rhodes says other companies should be clamoring to get into the Delilah business.
Quite frankly, the people at Martha Stewart Corporation should pick her up and do a Delilah magazine and should do a number of other products, because she is really representative of family.
Family is a dominant theme of her show with good reason. She's got 10 kids, 8 of them adopted. And with so much on her plate, Delilah says she's reluctant to accept the many, many offers she does get. In the meantime, she'll keep taking calls and picking the perfect song and keeping the whole schmaltzy enterprise going, if you don't mind me saying.
It is schmaltzy. Please, it is schmaltzy, it is sappy, it is saccharine, it is tear-jerking at times. It's like a chick flick.
And schmaltz pays. And there are few other venues where you can hear such an intimate look into the intricacies of contemporary American lives. You just can't hear the wind beneath my wings. I mean, really, that would just be too much. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo. Did you ever know that you're my hero? You represent how I would like to be. I can fly higher than an eagle.
The music of Philip Glass elicits an array of opinions. Some love it, some hate it, some just don't get it. That was especially true of Philip Glass's early music, like this piece, Music with Changing Parts, from 1970. On his website, Philip Glass's music from this period is elegantly described as immersing a listener in a sort of sonic weather that twists, turns, surrounds, develops. When he sat down to talk about a newly released retrospective of his work, Philip Glass was a bit more plain-spoken.
This is what people used to call the needle stuck in the groove music.
I
think it was meant pejoratively, but the point is that the kind of attention that we pay to music is a little bit different with this music, because events happen in the music, but rather more slowly than you're used to. So it's like taking a microscope and looking at something very close up, and you'll see things that you never would have seen before. That kind of happens to music when you slow down the rate of change. The music isn't slow, but the rate of change is slow.
If someone said Philip Glass's music puts me in a trance, you wouldn't take that as an insult.
No, but I would also point out that the players are not in a trance, or they wouldn't be able to play it. It takes a tremendous amount of discipline and concentration to do this kind of music. In those days, the days of the early 70s, I was playing all over the place. I remember I did a tour of New York City parks at one point with the Parks Department. I got a license from them, and we would set up, and whoever was around would be the audience, and I didn't explain what it was. I would just play the music. And we heard all kinds of things. We heard people saying, you guys can't play, or to some. I remember we were playing up in the Bronx someplace, and there was a bunch of young people there, and one guy said, "What do you call this music, mister?" And I said, "I don't know. What do you call it?" He said, "I call it Buddha rock." And it was hilarious to hear some young guy in the Bronx, this is what he heard.
I just wonder, when critics don't like your music, that they can be pretty...
Oh, they get very mean. Now, here's the thing, Renee, that you have to remember. Though we were vilified, and I particularly, you know, as the composer, by certain parts of the press, at the same time, we got huge amounts of attention. Without that kind of reaction, I doubt that we would have had the kind of public that we ended up with. People got curious about us, you know. I mean, if it was so bad, how bad, you know, what was it, you know?
So you would want to thank the headline writer in the early 70s who wrote, I'm just reading one of them, Music of Philip Glass Called Sonic Torture.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that was one of her favorite ones.
Thank you. grew up and did involve a father who owned a store that sold records.
Yeah, Ben Glass had a little record store. This is long before the days of when you had these mega stores, but it was one of the two stores in Baltimore that you could buy classical music. And my father, who was self-taught entirely, knew a lot about music. And I was in the store working. My brother Marty and I were in the store on weekends from the age of 12. Of course, in those days, that wasn't child labor because we weren't paid. So it was a family business. And we were there when Elvis Presley first came out, and we were handing his records over the counter. It was an amazing period. The music began to change very rapidly about that time. Rock and roll was beginning to show its face.
Rock and roll makes sense to me in a record store of the 1950s. But didn't your father stock the store with other more esoteric?
Oh, yes, he had everything, including what we call concert music or classical music. And what he did, he was a very interesting guy. When a record didn't sell, he couldn't sell a record, he would take it home he would listen to it to find out what was wrong with it. And what happened, he would listen to these things until he learned to like them. And he became an expert on contemporary music at that time just through listening to records. And he passed that on to me, and he passed that on to as many customers as he could. He would press these records on his customers and say, take this home and listen to this. He was a wonderful guy.
You know, I wonder, when you were growing up, were you fascinated, because I know you studied math, were you fascinated with Einstein?
I was fascinated with science. And Einstein, this was the first time that a scientist became a real rock star, and that was Einstein. I mean, now we have Stephen Hawking, and there have been many others, and Carl Sagan. There have been some very interesting people since then. What I liked about it, Renee, was that I saw the scientist as a kind of a poet, that Einstein would talk about how when he said, how did you get the theory of relativity? And he would say, well, I imagined myself on a beam of light traveling through the universe at the speed of light, and I tried to describe what I would see. And the theory of relativity is a description of what he thought he would see. So he was like a dreamer, a poet.
Einstein would later become the subject of your first opera,
yes.
Einstein on the Beach. If we were to pick up in Einstein on the Beach, where would you have us pick up to get a feel for it?
We'll start with the right after, a little bit of the beginning. I wouldn't play a lot of the beginning because it's a little repetitive. You don't have a lot of time. I don't want to. I mean, well, you know, let's put it this way. When you're home, you have unlimited time to listen to Einstein. When I'm on your radio program, people do not have unlimited time. Obviously, you hear numbers. The structure of the music I was writing then was very much about the simple manipulation of numbers.
Einstein on the Beach is included in a new box set of Philip Glass's work. It also includes symphonies, music for string quartets, avant-garde theater productions, and his film scores, like this piece from The Truman Show. The collection of 10 CDs called Glass Box underlines just how prolific Philip Glass has been for four decades.
I think it's a very good introduction to what I do, and not more than an introduction. I mean, 10 CDs, that's, what are we talking about, 600 minutes of music? I think that's enough. I'll keep you busy.
Philip Glass, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.